Good evening. My name is Jeannie Drews. I'm the Assistant Director for Access and Preservation here at the library, and it is my extreme pleasure to be able to introduce my friend and author Judith Kerman this evening. I actually know Judith through a Cuban connection and was less aware of her poetry until I read her book called Mothering, which, as I said to her this evening, was very, very powerful, and that I thought I couldn't say anything about it because it brought tears to my eyes when I told her how much I enjoyed, the wrong word, how moved I was by the poem. And so I hope that she reads something from it this evening. Judith has published 7 books as chapbooks of poetry, most recently Plain Surfaces, which is a wonderful cover. Her first edition, Mothering, received honorable mention in poetry in 1978. In the Great Lakes College Association New Writers Award Competition, and it's been, it has come out as a second edition of Mothering, published by Ridgeway Press in 1996, and again an expanded hypertext version in 1996. She received a Fulbright Senior Scholar Award to live in the Dominican Republic from January to July 2002. Otherwise, I would have had her here reading last January in conjunction with the Cuban book show that we did. She's published poems and translations of Dulce Maria Loynes, the Cuban poet, and then also of Dominican women poets. She teaches English and humanities and multimedia design at Saginaw Valley State University, and she has also published science fiction, an anthology on Blade Runner, and another selection, right, of science fiction
poetry, and the Blade Runner book is in scholarly articles.
Okay, I knew there were 2, and I didn't remember the other poem.
That one's here, the poetry book.
Okay, and as I said, I first heard about Judith through a Cuban connection. In an email she sent out when I was trying to find out about book artists in Cuba before I traveled there, and she very generously sent information out on a book arts list, which enabled me to find out about Ediciones Vigía, and we now have a large collection of those materials here at this library. And Judith has translations that have been published by Ediciones Vigía. So without more ado, I'd like to introduce Judith and let her read from her works.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure. Maybe I'll start with some of the translations. Dulce María Loynes was a very remarkable and in many ways enigmatic figure. She was born in 1902. She did all of her poetry, some of the writing after the revolution, but all of her poetry, as far as anybody knows, before the revolution, and she stopped writing poetry after the revolution. But she stayed in Cuba. She was able to leave, she was wealthy, she came from a very prominent family, but she was a patriot. Her father was a general in the revolution against Spain, and she said to somebody once, "I was here first," which I think gets something of her flavor. I discovered her work really entirely by accident when I was in Mexico studying Spanish. It was the week I could read enough to actually get anything at all out of reading in Spanish. And as I have sometimes said, it was like listening to Caruso records. There was all of this noise of my own weakness in the language and this amazing voice coming through. And I started translating her probably the night that I encountered her work with my equivalent of maybe 2 semesters of Spanish. But, you know, a lot of people think that to be a translator, you have to know the literature well, you have to know the language well. No. You have to be a good poet, a good writer in the recipient language, and you have to have some source to accurate information about what the original language says. I think it's a great help to also get to the point where you read the language well. But there are many fine translations where the author of the translations never got to really competent levels in the language. In fact, Robert Haas told me that he didn't have any Polish. Now he's got some, but he was translating Milosz with the help of Milosz, with the help of people who could tell him what the Polish was doing. I love her work. I have since translated contemporary poets, and I will read one poem by another contemporary woman, although she's a fairly older woman, so there's more overlap between the two of them than you might think. She writes all lengths. There are little tiny poems, and I will read you one little tiny poem, which I'm very fond of. And I'll read it to you in Spanish first, because to hear the music of her voice, who here has some Spanish? Anyone? Okay, well, all right, so maybe I'll do a little more than that. This is from her book called Poemas Sin Nombre, Nameless Poems, or Poems Without Name. And they're just numbered, so she was literal about that. This is number 57. No te nombro, pero estás en mí como la música en la garganta de Rusiñor, aunque no esté cantando. I do not say your name, yet you are within me like music in the throat of the nightingale, even when it is not singing. Where is one of the little tiny ones that I started with? Diologo. This is probably either the first or the second one that I ever did. The stars are falling. What are you saying, brother? They're only shooting stars. Stars are falling. What a strange idea. But look how the clear sky is letting loose its stars. Stretch out your hands so you can catch them. What are you saying, brother? They're shooting stars. There and gone, not falling, nothing you can gather. Never mind. Just stretch out your hands. Well, this is a long one, and it is one of my absolute favorite things. She tells an interesting story about this. This is La Novia de Lázaro. Novia is an interesting word in Spanish. It can mean boyfriend, girlfriend, in the case of novia, girlfriend. It can mean fiancé. It can mean bride. So there's a kind of slippiness about it, except that it's a significant other. We know that. And she told an interviewer in the 80s in a television program that when she wrote this, she was a little uncomfortable with it because she's a Catholic and she was afraid it was irreverent. Her husband, her second husband, Pablo de Cañas, was a Canarian. He was largely responsible for her reputation, and that was mostly in Spain because he had his contacts in Spain. And he promoted her very heavily. And he said, oh, we have to publish it. And she said, well, I don't know about that. And he said, what are these scruples you have? And she said, well, I want a priest or somebody to tell me whether this is okay. So he said, we'll take care of that. And he arranged for the bishop and the priest who married them to come to lunch. And he fed them wonderful food and terrific wine. And at the end of lunch, they asked whether it would be okay to publish La Novia de Lázaro. Because the premise is that Lazarus had a girlfriend. Lazarus, who was raised from the dead, had a girlfriend. And this is her response to his resurrection. Well, the priests and the bishop said, oh, that's fine, that's fine. And she said, but Father, are you sure? I mean, maybe I should read you a little of this. And he said, no, 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 no. And they gave me, she said, they gave me the Nihil Obstat. And I think even the story gives you a flavor of what she was like. This was a story she told when she was in her 80s. And then she said, to make a woman of 80 talk about love, that's the ultimate. So The Bride of Lazarus, and it's addressed to my sister Flor, with a quote from John 8:44, and he who had been dead came forth, his hands and feet rolled in bandages, and his face was wrapped in a shroud. You come to me at last, just as you were, with your ancient emotion and your unspoiled rose, Lazarus the straggler, a stranger to the fire of hope, forgetting disintegration even as it burnt to dust, ashes, nothing more. You return to me in one piece, and not even out of breath, with your great dream immune to the cold of the tomb, when already Martha and Mary, weary of waiting for miracles and plucking the leaves of twilight, have slowly descended the slope of all the Bethanies in silence. You come relying on no more hope than your own hope, no more miracle than your own miracle, impatient and sure of finding me still yoked to the last kiss. You come all flowers and new moon, quick to wrap me in your pent-up tides, in your stormy clouds, in your confused fragrances, which I begin to recognize one by one. You come still yourself, safe from time and distance, safe from silence, and bring me like a wedding gift the already savored secret of death. But here I am, a bride again, not knowing whether I rejoice or weep at your return, over the terrifying gift you give me, even over the joy which strikes me like a blow. I don't know whether it is late or early to be glad. Truly, I don't know. I no longer remember the color of your eyes. You say it's not late, that death has no more taste than water. You say it was barely a month ago when we left you behind the terrible stone of the sepulcher, and they haven't even harvested the wheat, which was green the morning you and I went out to gather honeycomb and we kissed for the last time. I never kept track of time then, you know that. I only began counting after you left, began to die under the numbers and the hours and the days, which grew infinite in my count, the way infinite anguishes fit into each instant of a bad dream. Why do you want me to count well now, to hurry now, when I have ground my teeth blunt on the edges of haste? I waited a century hoping for nothing, and you can't wait a minute hoping for everything? Tell me, Lazarus, could it have been harder to come back to life than it would have been to stay here, where my soul embraced yours, struggling with death until bled dry? Come now, rein in the horses of your newborn blood and sit with me. Begin to know me again. I am new now, too, from being so old, from the millennia I aged while the wheat ripened toward the same harvest, while yours was just the nap of a young child, innocent and brief. And don't be impatient, my beloved, that I learned patience a letter at a time with blood and welcomed it. It's no mystery to me that happiness isn't willing to wait. It's time to be happy now or it never will be. The good which I gave up as lost has been returned to me, the love, the sweetness around the hearth, children, vigils by the lamp in winter, beneath the twining vines in summer, one sweet thing after another, trivial, but each one reaching to the boundaries of time. All this begins to take shape, to place itself newly within reach of my hand and my small feminine capacity to imagine my good fortune. But even though I understand, it's not my fault that this good fortune takes me by surprise, catches me unprepared like guests at a party who arrive before the house is ready. Time was needed to arrange everything, and in truth I did many times until I couldn't anymore. And the dust continued to fall, settling over the masterless house. Don't get started, my Lazarus, spinning me stories about dust. I am an old bride who needs to be forgiven her clumsiness, her withered skin, and eyes still closed to miracles. I am an old bride, and this dawn you arrive in, wherever you come from, a place no one has ever come from before, is either a new daybreak or else much too old as the first daybreak of the world. All of life, all of creation, all of you yourself lie before it. I alone am left behind. Still in the wheat fields of that morning, still in the kiss lost among the wheat fields, still standing in everything that has ceased to be or that never was. Like the first dawn of this world, that's what this is, and I must get used to it. But adjusting my heart takes time, and there's no point in hurrying. I had a long night. Don't you understand? You also had one, and I don't deny it, but you were dead, and I was alive. You were dead and floating in your death like a lake without shores, like a child before birth in the harbor of its mother's blood. But I stayed alive, my eyes wanting to pierce your darkness, my bones refusing to hold me up, my flesh chewed, tortured by black angels in rebellion against God. You were dead, and I stayed alive, feeling the pace, the weight, the persistence of the night, and I had to bear it, unable either to die or to push it away. To push death away, that's what I tried to do, to move the immovable, the blind, the deaf, the mute. But someone else did it. He came and the night became dawn. Death became play. The world became a child again. He came and time stopped, parted before his smile as the waters of the Red Sea did for our ancestors. Nothing more was needed. Just to cry a little, smile a little, and then everything was as it should be, sweetly, simply, lazily. Now, you are his work, born again of his miraculous word. From now on, any words you say to me will only be an echo of his, overwhelming, victorious over death. They'll be words that don't know how to tear themselves from your breast, living or dead, or take victory from his hand, or drink from my thirst. They'll penetrate my punctured soul through hope, like strange flowers sprouting in a well. Would it be right for you to use those words to swear love to me at my window, to soothe me like a sick calf, to sing to the sound of the lute, as you like to do late afternoons coming home from the fields? I don't know, and you can't know it either now. I knew you were here, still pale, still glowing with your dazzling daybreak, your mouth giving back kisses that you didn't have time to give before. But I also know that something ineffable has happened between you and me. And although I am here as you are, I'm still outside the prodigy, a stranger to what was done to your lips, to your body, to your soul, to everything that once was mine. True, life is urgent, and we need not ask for more miracles than that miracle. Life is urgent, and your lips are near, the rosy half moon of your face. I could kiss them if I wished, and I will want to soon, my love. But what fear, like leprosy, what eternal doubt, whether I am kissing now what I kissed before, and anyway, whether it was worth bringing it back to life. I will learn again the flight of your herons, the tiny rivers of your blood, the intimacy of your bright beacons. We will erase the scrapes left by death's wingtips, the little scars, light or shadow, in your ransomed flesh. I will find everything lost, the honey that pleased you, the song that made you smile, and the one which once earned your tears. And once more, I will tie a ribbon to my braid, pretend to be a bride at my window. But what if you were the one who couldn't find me? What if you searched in vain for what you had abandoned behind this window, bedecked in vain? If you couldn't recognize your bees in the honey, and in my offering of myself, you got only my phantom? What if it was you who, in your turn, talked to me and I was deaf? Kissed me and I was cold, shook me and I was rigid. You who were shocked to see me dead, dead, yes, inexorably dead, even my smile already liberated from whatever glory or tragedy could have been our destiny. Ah, you tremble, Lazarus, because up to now you've only wanted to go on being yourself, and you haven't asked yourself whether I would come along with you. Maybe I died before your eyes, which still see me alive. Maybe I died an instant after we met, of the shock of your lost face striking in every corner of my bones. The collision of your presence and my memory, your reality and my dream, your new ephemeral life and the other to which I had already given you, where you floated, perfect, marvelous, immutable, madly defended. Yes, I am the one who has died, and no one knows it. Go and tell the one who passed by, the one who might return, who might raise me too and command me to walk. And I'm not a Christian. It still does that. Wow. Excuse me. Okay. Well. A change of tone, I think. I went through these last night and kind of looked at some fairly recent things. And well, maybe the thing to do is a little, since that was a very Christian poem, a little Jewish poetry. This is called cholent, and cholent is a stew, basically, that's prepared Friday and left in the oven. And at the time I wrote this, I thought it was made of meat and fruit, and I'm not sure about the fruit part, but meat and vegetables and sometimes fruit. So it is a traditional Sabbath dish. The tradition is a stone building, windows filled with yellow light, black letters, square and mysterious as granite. Wrought iron, that other voice, Arbeit macht frei, spreading its arms across the gate. The sword turns at the door. I sit by Grandpa, a wriggling toddler, the only female in the shul. I do not see a balcony, a curtain hiding the women. Old men in black fedoras bow and sing. The echo of the flames is close in our ears. I do not know the names of Grandpa's brothers who died before I was born. Fridays, women in other houses rush about, cleaning and cooking, heating the oven to keep the cholent hot, meat and fruit, a stewing sweetness I've never tasted. My mother didn't stand, white cloth on her head, lighting candles. At Hanukkah, when I put the menorah in the window, I hear the glass breaking. Those who understand these images, those who don't. The books open the wrong way. Yellow light lies under the apple trees like honey. Heritage. The first time I met you, you were marrying my cousin, the one you said was different. Sweet face and sugared condescension, you think you're beyond the dirty collars and mule dung of your people. I hide from you, the one you would call the little Jew, my ancestor. His passion reached above the stink of stairwells and leaky roofs, bean soup in the anteroom, gas lights glowing yellow in the dust of old books. He wanted justice. He was an ordinary man, ashes in his pocket. He wanted to be chosen. People who I imagine looked like you, people who worshipped your martyred god, broke his bones and raped his daughter. I don't want to remember how his anger curled into a club. Better to burn the Torah than teach it to women. All my life, I've run from him, from you. I want to speak past it, woman to woman, but I don't know what's possible. A man at the shul tells me what the goyim did to us. Who cares if she's offended? Learning Haftorah. Now, Haftorah is the reading of the prophets. Every Saturday, and a couple other times during the week, but in the U.S. it's mostly on Saturday, there's a reading of the Torah portion. And during times when it was illegal and dangerous to read the Torah, the rabbis chose portions of the prophets that seemed to be related to the same topic. And they were allowed to read the prophets. So now in services you have both. You have the Torah portion for the week, and you have the appropriate Haftorah or prophets. And usually at a bar mitzvah, these days the kids learn the Haftorah because reading Torah is harder, and it's sort of something that the professionals do, but you don't expect most kids to learn it, although the better students do. Learning Haftorah. Student and teacher bend together over the book every week for hours. The hooks of the letters tangle and unwind. Ancient music groans in the child's ear. Why should he deny the sunlight? For what? 60 years ago, when the teacher was a boy, telegrams arrived. Foreboding hung in his parents' voices. There was nothing he could do but study. He was a soldier of books in a war against forgetting. The boy he teaches resents the sacrifice, but he's a good boy, his mother tells him. So he comes and works, watches the teacher's knobby finger move across the page. Sometimes he thinks for a moment he can hear the old voices. Sometimes at home, the book on his desk, jammed between his math text and the soccer ball, suggests a kind of destiny. Like the drone of a mosquito, he tries to brush it away. A lot of people know that after your menstrual period or after you have a baby, a woman goes to the ritual bath, the mikveh. A lot of people don't know that all converts go to the mikveh, and Orthodox men often do. And in general, it's a kind of, well, it's the original of baptism, but it's a more intimate sort of thing because it's something available to people anytime. And I've only actually done that once, the year that I was bat mitzvah, when I was 50. And this came out of that. Mikveh. The bath place should be blue water reflecting open sky, like floating in my mother, perfect dependence. Remember to breathe. Remember the world outside. Affirm the skin I wear is Jewish. Dark shadows below the surface, piles of hair. Duck my head 7 times, let it all float away. Soon enough I will emerge from this sounding ocean. And this is the last of that. which is beginning to feel like a sequence. You all know what a star-nosed mole is? Well, it is a real thing. It lives in this kind of country. It is a mole, and it has a very strange nose that sort of looks like a star, kind of little tendrils or tentacles or something. And this is called star-nosed mole. So imagine this, and the poem describes her pretty well, I think. For Larry Pike, one of us who lived in Royal Oak and died a few years ago, star-nosed mole. Afterward, God imagined a mole. Snatch of dark fur, pale polyp flower of a nose, snuffling through the dirt. Imagined her passing through cloth like the needle of a blind tailor turning hems by touch. Imagined the shovel claws scraping toward the knot of black roots, the ears deep in the skull, listening for small movements, the eyes no more than stitches in a shroud. Even now, all these years later, the light of her star gleams down the long tunnels. I don't know why I put this here. A friend of mine is doing a haiku book collection, and she asked us, her friends, for other sort of odd things, and these are sci-fi-ku. And there are four of them, but I decided I really liked them. So they are one thing called sci-fi-ku. Two moons shining in water, overlapping rings. I am of two minds. Which seems to me a very zen sort of idea. Where have you gone now? On what planet will we meet, your black fur shining? The void between stars, I am blown apart, gas clouds after a nova. Event horizon, my full heart when I see you, drawing me closer. I really like science fiction, but didn't expect to do those. I've been working on this for a very long time, and I hope I've finished it. It's called Sea Glass. You all know what that is, right? Okay. It kind of describes it anyway. Long walk, searching for shells and pebbles to take home. Ocean smells like pickle. Sunlight catches deep in the green. Breakers coil and loom, then crumble, a crowd of children rushing up and back. Nothing is still, even for a moment. Fragments of sea glass glisten clear as jelly in the froth, dry in my hand to a mesh of lines and scratches, like the dry velvet of an old lady's cheek. What did they say before the sea carved them blank? They glow with milky light, cobalt, amber, aquamarine. A sly joke, the sand turning back into sand after a detour through machinery. The ocean uncurls its white tongue, licks the edges clean. Two of them are a little funny, and the other one is just, I think, different from anything else I've read. This is called Conundrum. Maybe you were broadcasting a tune to which I've always been quite deaf as you hung out with the band in the parking lot, all leather jacket, tight jeans, buzz and gleam of electric guitars. Maybe the pheromones drifted from you to me as we watched young lovers stroll by the duck pond with their plastic bags full of stale bread. When the ducks began that eager quacking rush across the water, I always wondered how they knew from so far away. It's a mystery, not once across a crowded room, but a commonplace. Over coffee, I notice how well your new suit fits you. I catch you looking back, but I have no magic decoder ring. The invisible ink does not darken over the candle flame. And although this is a little bit newer, it's sort of for my students. I keep having students in my creative writing classes who are engaged, and they write love poems for their usually boyfriends. And every so often I have a pregnancy in my creative writing class, and somebody disappears for a week and comes back deflated and maybe breastfeeding out in the lobby during the break. So this is kind of for those students. It's called Engagement. Even as we are walking through town hand in hand, and I feel the callus along the edge of your palm ridged like a nail file, I imagine that roughness catching on my nylons as you roll them off. Such gentle invitations, but I laugh and say, don't run them, it's my last pair. We stop outside the ice cream parlor, and I imagine sharing a cone on the sunny sidewalk, our tongues bumping into each other, the cherry vanilla dripping all over. And another food, well, it's not quite a food poem, it's partly a food poem, Saffron. Now, I have to say about this, when I wrote it, I didn't get it. And people kept saying, oh, they really liked it. So I've sort of figured out why, but I'm not sure even yet. It's kind of chunks, saffron. The shirt I always imagine wearing. Not coral, not gold, but I can never quite focus on the difference. Fragrant rice smell like that cinnamon and turmeric stew, almost that color. Buddhist monks' robes, hot sunset, tangerine, aglow, not salmon, like the light of October maples reflecting off low clouds, flames of the end of summer. Hot, 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 the fragrance of cinnamon, cumin, and onion, cream of tomato soup, too pastel, my frustrated efforts at color mixing, wanting saturation, brilliance. Why not pick an easier color? I need an old National Geographic article on Burma. No words for it. Not sweet, not hot. The glow persists. Paella in a Spanish cafe near the ocean. I sometimes assign rituals to my students. And this is one that I did, partly to show them what it was, but I like it. Ritual for relocation, for all those who would like to. One. Nail the map of where you want to live in a sunny spot on your wall. 2, walk your fingers down the main street. 3, study the phone book to find a company you might like to work for. 4, wrap that page of the phone book around something small that you value. 5, bury the packet in the backyard of a rich person. 6, do this every day. 7, when no pages remain and the map has faded away, move to that town. I seem to be working on some music poems, and I will read a few of these. Sonata for Kitchen Table. Solitary pedestal, wrought iron and complicated, with cranks and set screws, a dream of the 19th century, a symphonic composition. Wheels that score the flooring with rust smudges where the wash water lingers in dents on the vinyl, linoleum, asbestos tile, generations of flooring under its wheels, a triumphal march of domestic fashion, but without elephants. My kitchen is empty. I don't cook often, though I have a percussion section, pots, pressure cooker, wok, steel whip, saboteur, chef's knives. I don't know how the top got this gouge, but I understand where. Scars and wrinkles, the varnish, urethane, almost down to the grain of the old wood, the real ivory piano keys. And this is quite recent, and it's one of a small group of experiments in bilingual poetry, but I think you'll get it, even if you don't have the Spanish. It's called Una Lección de Tambora, a drum lesson. Sitting on a concrete bench in the shade of the museo's towering concrete wall, Dagata with Muñeco, whose name means doll baby, and they've got that right, espresso skin and white smile, sonrisa como sunrise in la noche, and his fast hands. Dagata, el calor del sol moves slowly toward us, la luz y la sombra, and a gardener is watering a faint smell of sewage de la tierra mojada, y los niños escolares walk by in their matching blue blouses to visit the Taino Indian exhibits, stop, fascinados by the big Americana, vieja como mi abuela, a pañuelo round her head, keeping sweat from her eyes, drumming. Tagata! This is the pañuelo. That's a true poem, although, as I have often said, that doesn't make it work. It has to be a poem first, then it can be true, and then it's just fun. Figure. I'm dropping a paper ribbon from the 14th floor as the astronaut goes by down below in his open limousine, waving, ribbons and confetti tangling in the sun above his head like laurels coming down, or doves. Favored son, he glows in the Klieg lights. God, even God, is applauding, and the air smells of popcorn. You can smell it even up here, and exhaust from motorcycles, a flashing blue constellation. Well, I want to wrap up, I think, with a little of Jenny the Lump. Jenny the Lump is a character that I invented many years ago, and the first poem is really a New York poem, and then it sort of traveled from there, and some of them are fairly recent. In Spanish, she is called Jenny el Terron, which I guess means Jenny the Lump. And I don't think I'll read this. Well, maybe read one of the Spanish translations, but this is Jenny the Lump Gets Molested. Jenny the Lump was only 4 feet high and round, so some people thought she was easy. One time, she was walking down 8th Avenue, just enjoying the evening air, when some dude came along and thought, the fool, he'd grab some ass, which she had a fair amount of. Well, Jenny the Lump reached around behind and swatted him headfirst through 3 blocks of storefronts into a vat of spaghetti sauce on 23rd Street. This is my short, fat, female Paul Bunyan character. Jenny the Lump learns to knit. The wool in the spinner's parlor glows, sumptuous. Knit one, she chants, purl one. Her accountant says he has other clients who knit as he does their taxes, but they're mostly older. She heals slowly. Trouble and disappointment pick at her innards. 4 needles to make slippers, mittens, or skull caps. The cat is chewing on plastic shopping bags. Knit harder. She can knit in front of the TV set. Can she knit in meetings? At the president's welcome speech? In bed? Instead of sleep? Instead of sex? Did Nero knit while Rome burned? Well, I think maybe I will finish with a little of mothering. I've always experienced it as a kind of somebody said it was sort of like a concerto. There's this primary voice, and there are all of these motifal things going on. And I tend to read sequences. Let's see. One of the figures in the book, I always said if I were French, it would be my novel. Since I'm an American, it's a poem, is a deep sea diver. She sees him walking toward her across the sea floor, slow motion. The light is blue and shifting. It falls in curtains and rays. There are fish all around, swimming between them like stars, blue and striped and shiny. He walks like a robot. If he holds her, she will hear his engine running. She can feel nuts and bolts holding his elbows together. She says, deep sea diver, I love you with your silence, with your dark blue movements, with the world floating away, with birth and death in one place. Rocking, 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 the tide coming slowly into shore, chains of kelp twisting and pebbles rolling along the bottom, the hermit crabs groping in their borrowed shells along the bottom. He is rocking her at the bottom of the sea. The grouper swims by and stares in through the nursery window. Nice looking kid, he says to deep sea diver. Is it a girl? He is giving 8 cigars to the octopus. He smiles. Everyone's happy. She worries about her guppy tank. They keep dying. She doesn't know what to do. She remembers her father's tank in the basement, full of dust. All the fish died, and he gave it up. The starfish is kissing her with his suction cups. The blue light shifts around her like satin. Sometimes she thinks he brings the light with him like an aura. She says, you're a planet, and it's your atmosphere. Their bubbles float upwards. When she is with him, she is sometimes very witty. She doesn't know what to do. She says, how can I keep this? I can't swim. How can I stay here with you? What do you want? She sees him smiling through the faceplate. He is saying something, but all she hears is bubbles. It sounds like, "Kiss me, stupid," and she starts to get mad. "Rock me some more," she says. "I don't want to think about it." She dissects a frog. The scalpel makes a neat line from breastbone to anus. She pulls the thin green skin aside, the pale muscles. The odor of formaldehyde makes her eyes water. In her father's factory, the same smell comes to her from permanent press coats. Then she watches the vet autopsy a kitten, the healthy red lungs and liver. Mothering is so difficult to read. When she really looks at her, without mercy or hope, she can't tell whether she is stupid or malevolent. She searches. There always seems to be a shortage of information. She says, "If I could find the heart, I would cast it in gold for remembrance. But it seems to be a medical anomaly." She takes out large intestine, gallbladder, kidneys, small intestine, urinary bladder, ovaries, uterus. She suddenly realizes she's working on the wrong end of the problem. She takes out liver and lungs. She tracks blood vessels down in both directions. When there is nothing left but the spine, like an abandoned railroad, she looks at all the pieces, carefully labeled. It's puzzling. She can't figure it out. She opens the skull and takes the brain out, trying to read the veins and convolutions like a map showing her where she needs to go. She wants to take the heart and liver wrapped in bacon for hors d'oeuvres to some festival where the mystery will finally be solved, everyone partaking, and revelations showering down like manna in the morning. She wants to bite the heart in half and find herself curled up in the ventricle like a treasure, like a work of art. She says, "If I could find the heart, I would hang it in my chest to light the way." She hears mothering's laugh, an eclipse of the sun. I finally understood this fairy tale. Walking in the desert, she sees something lying in the sand. She picks it up. It is a lamp. She says, "How boring. I've heard this one already." She can't read the inscription because it's dirty, so she begins to rub and polish. She feels like her mother's daughter, always cleaning. The lamp grows larger, but nothing happens. Walking in the desert, she sees something lying in the sand. She picks it up. It is a penis. When she rubs it, a genie appears who says, "I am the pleasure principle. You have 3 wishes." Another character in this is a child who lives with her, kind of a... It's very strange. I mean, I wrote this book like 25 years ago, and I still don't know the name of the lead character or where this kid came from. But anyway, she lives with this kid. Watering the avocado seed, watering the false Aurelia, hoping it will come true, watering the purple passion, its leaves curling away from the cold window, the sprengeri scrawny from winter sun, everything waiting, and April snow falling outside. Waiting for the fat brown tabby to come into the room, speak, purr, looking up at her, but the cat's dead. She doesn't know whether she's sentimental because she's sad or hard-hearted because she doesn't cry. Cat, 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 where are you? Babies burning, baby faces in the newspaper. She's so far away, abstracted. The child's smooth arms and legs. Touch him, hold his head in her hands like a stone, bone, soft skin, hair drifting under her fingers. In his dream, 2 sisters lie together impaled on the same sword. He won't tell her. She imagines everything. His eyes, gunfire and flame. Loneliness is a stone in her throat waiting to fall. She wants him to let her into memory, but he keeps it locked. Sometimes she holds the newspaper clippings, flaking brown at the edges when he's out of the house. She should burn them. They're an obsession. His only legacy, a map of scars. Well, just one more, even though it's kind of a minor poem, perhaps. But I think we're at that season, if I can find it. Advisory. The radio says it will snow all night. From the porch, nothing moves but the tick of flakes descending under the streetlight. The echoes dim and die between the taciturn old houses. A tidy line of cat prints edging the driveway is already blurring. Far away, snowplow engines start at the city garage. Thank you. think it is customary to take questions, if there are any.
I'm curious, Judith, how you see poetry, and because you teach multimedia, how you see those coming together or diverging or the future. I don't know. It just seems like because you work with both of them.
It's a puzzle to me. You know, in the 80s, I did an interactive poetry authoring system. I wrote an interactive poem, and then I got somebody to write a kind of program because I didn't find writing the thing in BASIC all that edifying, so that anybody could write one. And I also started thinking about the relative, the difficulty of the aleatory. The problem that I see with hypertext as a literary form, and I still see it as a problem, is that the job of the author is to entrain the reader's attention, to lead the reader to experiences through a sequence of time. And every time you have to make a choice in a hypertext, you're thrown out of that into a different kind of thinking altogether. And I mean, mothering exists as a hypertext. And basically what I did was all those things that I see as themes, like all the poems about the child, or all the poems about deep sea dive, or all the poems about desert landscapes, are linked together so that you can read through on the desert landscape thread, or you can read through on the child thread. And there are things in the hypertext that are not in the book, because I took them out of the play, which is published for the first time in this edition. But it's not... I'm sorry, to me, it's not reading, and I did it. I was one of the first people who did it, and I did picture poems. I did a sort of picture poem of E.E. Cummings' Grasshopper, which I kind of actually like. They're animations, and I think people are actually doing very interesting things with them, but they are in the tradition of graphic poetry and concrete poetry, and that... I can't remember if it was Helen. I'm sure Helen Bendler wasn't the first person who said it. That consensual fantasy, that dream that we are in when we are in the space that an author creates for us. I think there is a space like that in the web and in CD-ROM, but I don't think we've figured out how to use it yet. And somehow that decision-making process, that moving from here to here part, is the part we haven't figured out. Things I've seen that I think are effective are basically animations. They're word picture poems, and some of them are very effective. But the thing that makes the internet and the computer unique isn't animation. You can do that with a drawing board or a flip book. It's the interactivity. It's the point of making where the reader makes a decision about what happens next. And to do that in a way that is emotionally rich, no matter which way you make the choice, I think we haven't figured it out. I've looked at some of the, you know, some of the great works in hypertext. They're not really interesting reading to me. Some of it because people are doing it who are better techies than they are writers. But some of those people I think are good writers, and yet there's just something that I want in the experience of reading that I actually think the computer may interfere with. I think the web is a wonderful thing. I use it all the time. I use it as an encyclopedia. I use it as the place to find the phone number when I want to get customer service for something that I lost the receipt for years ago. I use it to find travel agents. I use it to find out what temperature is like someplace that I'm going to go. It's wonderful. And there's something there. There has to be an art form buried in there, but I don't think we figured it out yet. And I haven't. I'm trying to work on it some, but mostly I need about 3 more lives.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a few words about Earth's Daughters?
I found it, basically, yeah. Well, in the 70s, I went back to graduate school in 1969-70, and I had, as I think a lot of people who end up being small press people do, a poem in my pocket, something that somebody had read at a workshop in Connecticut when I was living in Connecticut the year before, that I thought somebody ought to publish. And I also thought that there were enough literary magazines in the world. And I guess the women's movement made me think about that again. and made me look at the same thing that I looked at when I decided to translate Dominican women, that there were 9, 10, 11, 20 men for every woman in the magazines, in the anthologies, and I saw that there was a need. Not that I think editors don't want to publish women, but that women didn't feel welcome, that there needed to be a place that said, this is where you are invited, where you are welcome. We always published men as well as women. But our philosophy was, and I think it still is, because the magazine is still running in Buffalo, issue number 59 just hit my mailbox. The philosophy always was any work by a woman that is artistically truthful is inherently feminist because it tells the truth about women's lives. Men we will publish too, but they have to be more specifically feminist. And that's been the way the magazine has operated over the years. I left it behind. Actually, it became a collective before I left Buffalo. And I left it behind, and it's still going, and it feels very strange to be the mother of a cultural institution. Mayapple Press, which is my small press, is a much more single-person thing, and in practice, it hasn't been as political. But I want it to be more about the Great Lakes, and I want it to be more about women than it has been, and I am moving toward that. And I'm actually thinking about a Latin American sub-track because, you know, particularly bilingual books, it's hard. I didn't send my Dulce María Loynes anthology to Dennis Maloney for a long time because I know him from graduate school. And I thought, you know, somebody ought to do this just because it's worth doing, just because she's unknown and she's a Cervantes winner and Cuba is important and people don't know enough. And they turned it down. And I kept getting, oh, nice project, too bad we can't do it, from Berkeley. And, you know, like three or four places actually wanted to see the manuscript. And now I know why when I say to Robert Hess or somebody like that, that I've got a book from, or Diane, that I've got a book from White Pine, they say, oh yeah, White Pine's a good place, because everybody else is dropping the ball. Dennis is interested in Latin American, in poetry and translation from all over the world, in the work of women, and he's doing this, you know, on his kitchen table while he has a day job. He's a bit more professional about it than I am able to be with my press, but I'm working on that too. And thank God for Publish on Demand, because it makes things possible that never were before. But I'm proud of Earth's Daughters, my baby, and seeing it continue and seeing people back in Buffalo. You know, there's a community of women that have passed through Earth's Daughters, some of whom are still there after many years, Castle Brill in particular. And we've published some people that are well known now, Susan Fromberg Schaefer, Olga Brumas, in the first year or so. It was important to us. It still is. And there was always a philosophy, which I guess I still have, that it has to be physically beautiful. It has to be interesting as an object. When we first started, we had like, you know, six poems and two drawings in a little folder. That was the first issue. If it isn't handsome, it will vanish from sight. And I still hold to that, and I'm pleased that people like my book designs, because I learned it from working with people like Judith Tribal, who was our first art director. Originally, it was basically Mindy Aloff and me and Judith Tribal. We started it. Judith went in one direction, Mindy went in another direction. Lillian Robinson was part of it for a long time, Lillian S. Robinson, who's an important critical scholar. And it's turned over, but they're still there. Castle Brill, who's still on the magazine, did the artwork for this, which was originally, I mean, this was the same artwork on the first edition, the 1978 edition. And it was originally a broadside for the second or third number of Earth's Daughters. We didn't happen to use that particular drawing for some technical reasons, but I really liked it, and I still have it. And took a little tiny piece of the drawing, blew it up large. This was before computers. I used to do, well, this, for example, started out as a photograph in a catalog for a nightlight, a ceramic nightlight in the shape of a yellow cab. And I Xeroxed it, and I inked it, because I can't draw. And I did, you know, generations of tracing paper and Xeroxing and inking things in and making them bigger so I could clean them up and making them smaller again, and French curves for the road. And this grid stuff that used to be put out by the people who made Press Type which I suppose has long since gone bankrupt because the computer makes press type kind of obsolete, to put it mildly. But I remember the excitement of breaking the frame. You know, having the taxi coming out of the frame was like, oh, where did I learn to do that? How cool. And I love book design. That's how I ended up meeting Gene, because I ended up making handmade books. Because somebody that I met in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, all of 12 years ago, who is a book artist, Mary Jane Kidd, rebound some rubber stamp picture poems that I had done in a blank book, and there were way too many pages, and I said, oh, I never finished, and she said, no, you just need to rebind them so that it would just be a book that had what I had actually done in it. And as I watched her make this little book, I thought, oh my God, that's all there is to it? And this I had done in the Dominican Republic, was published by the, I never can remember the full name of the organization, Critica Canadiense Literaria sobre Escritoras Hispanoamericanas, or rather, Critica Dominicana, the organization interested in literature by Hispanic women, and I'm not Hispanic, but they've let me be part of it by adoption, I guess. It's hand-sewn. It's an edition of 250, and I sit there with my template and my long needle, and I punch three holes, and every one of these things is going to have my hand in it in that way, partly because I think it's an elegant way to do a book and more economical than trying to perfect bind something this size, and it will last a whole lot longer than a perfect binding anyway.
And be easier to read.
But staples would have been tacky, whereas a little bit of real linen bookbinder's thread is elegant, even though it's more work. But that's a book arts piece. Well, thank you all for coming. It really was great fun reading for you. And you probably have guessed that these are for sale.